This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 159. Unbelievable. You know, I was thinking the other day that when I started naming these internally, I called it driving home underscore 0001. Because I wanted to make sure I had enough space. And I thought at the time, I'm not sure I really need that fourth zero on there. Because with three zeros, that would be 999 episodes I could record. And the fact of the matter is, I don't think there's any way I will ever get to 999 episodes. On the other hand, if you've got 52 episodes a year, I mean, it's, what, 12, 15, 20 years, 2019 years? Yeah, probably not, but you never know. I thought I better add the extra zero on there so we don't have to ruin our naming conventions. Anyways, it has been a good week. Got started on a new little project this week that will hopefully just be a short-termer. But actually am learning about Microsoft Dynamics CRM now, so it's pretty interesting. Lots of new stuff. I mean, it's just big and thick. It's like when I was starting to learn SharePoint. It's like I'm just scrambling my way up, but I only had about, maybe a day and a half, and you know, we figured out how to get some data into it already. Some of the other guys had worked on it a little bit and then got pulled off on other things, and so they had some data in it. So we were looking at that and decided whether we wanted to keep that or whether we wanted to move in a different direction. And so it was pretty interesting, and got some other things into play. Now we're watching one of the important subsystems on a project I've been working on, watching it work now at night. It seems to be going fine, so it's always nice when things work. The writing is going well. I'm in the big chapter now, the darkness. Actually, I'm in the knowing now, which is the chapter after the darkness, and I actually did not expect to have it be a separate chapter, but it worked out like that. I think this book is going to come in at 160 pages, not 140, part four of Grumpy Old Prophets. And I might cut it down after I go through and edit it up. Who can say? At this point, I'm just trying to get the big climax of this book done. It's going pretty good. It's going, you know, writing is so interesting. Really, any creative endeavor, it's just so fascinating. Because you only see a little bit. You get these glimpses. I had years ago when I was thinking about the Easter story, this book, I had this one image in my brain that was all the way down to the crucifixion scene, and I didn't know how I was going to get there. I didn't know what, but this one image, it's kind of this seminal image, this important moment I had in my brain. And it turns out it's not even the most important moment of this whole thing. But then I knew kind of that was a goalpost I wanted to get to, and so I kind of worked my way around and got to that. And then there's like, you have this other image, and it's, oh yeah, I got to get over there too. And so then you kind of work your way over to that image, and it's like, oh yeah, I got to go there, and maybe I can change that. But I think it's going to be fine. I think I was out yesterday. I had written on it some, and of course Wednesday is my fast day, and so I don't write much on Wednesday because I'm just shot by the time I get to about 7 o'clock at night. But I hadn't gotten enough exercise, and so I thought, well, I'll go out and go for a little walk. But as I was walking, then I thought, oh, yeah. Because you get another little glimpse of something. And so pulled out my phone and scribbled it down on Evernote real quick. Yeah, I got to do that too. Yeah. So fascinating. I can make people cry. Because that's like the big thing to move people emotionally. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be fine. I do have to take my dad in for a doctor's appointment to a cardiologist. He's 89 now, and they said his kidneys aren't working as well as they could. He's still feeling pretty good. But in addition to that, he was at the dentist several weeks ago and was really having some heart pains. He thinks it's just gas, but we're going to the cardiologist for a little checkup, and my wife isn't able to take him on this particular one, and so I'm going to run him down tomorrow, and we're going to get that taken care of. It's interesting because he's ready. You know, he's still functioning very well, and he's having a little trouble with his eyesight and a few little aches and pains here and there, but he's done everything he felt like he needed to do, and so he's pretty well determined that, you know, no matter what they tell him down at the cardiologist, that he is not going in the hospital, he is not going on extra medication, he just said, you know, I'm ready. Everything's fine. It's been a good life. My mom would like him to stay around a little longer. She doesn't want him to die until after she dies. But my mom's family, they all live into their 90s. So Dad is saying, I'm 5 years older than she is. If I have to wait till the 90s, I'm going to be like 94. I don't want to wait that long. So, it's kind of nice. It's nice that they're not really stressing about this. And since my dad is 89 and my mom is 85, we're going to cross this bridge at some point in the somewhat near future. But Jesus will be with us through it. We've got their burial plans all put together, took care of that. I really need to get their living wills put together with them so that we've got directives on file so that we don't have to deal with that if and when the time comes. I'm kind of halfway hoping that they both go at the same time. I think it would be easier on both of them if they both went at the same time, but we'll see. No matter what happens, we'll be okay. In other big news, tonight is my daughter's first performance with the skinny improv group Betty and the Baldwin. So I called her today, told her she was going to be great. It's actually a wedding reception that they're going down to, and I thought about going. I would have to, like, do the Wedding Crashers thing to do it. And it's in a small room, and so it's, like, going to be a private affair. And I could probably get in, put on a suit, and go down and smile a lot and get in. I could probably, but it's all the way down in Branson. Like a 40-minute drive. And she's going to have a performance on Sunday night, and I will probably take her to that. So either I'm going to take her to that, or her hubby is going to take her to that, and I'm going to stay with Clara while she's sleeping. So, you know, it's going to be fine. The one on Saturday is going to be her official first performance in front of a live audience. So it's going to be great. She's going to do fine. It's going to be great. Anyways, so that's that. I don't know if there's any. Everything else is just puttering along. It's been a good week. I had a lovely breakfast this morning. Just a lovely breakfast this morning with a new friend. And really enjoyed it. It was good. Got a chance to talk about you know, some of those core foundational things that I think I've learned in my life. And it's fun. It's fun to go over that and, you know, just kind of hand it off to someone else and say, there you go. You can kind of do whatever you want to do with it. But this is what I think I've learned. And so it's fun to watch people thinking about that and, you know, then taking it with them and pondering it some more. So it was good. It's good. Anyways, this week I stumbled across a TED Talk. My wife and I were out, I think on Saturday, and she needed to drop in and get some extra Easter cards because we were going to her mom's house for Easter dinner, and they have a couple of international students, a couple of Japanese gals, that one of them was their international student that they're kind of looking after, and then they had some friends who weren't going to be able to be in for Easter who had an international student that they were looking after as well. They had adopted, and so since her people were going to be gone, then my parents-in-law invited her as well. So we got a chance to chat a little bit with them. Very lovely, lovely gals. But we didn't have Easter cards for them, and Lynette, who has a really good heart, thought, oh, I should drop by Dollar General. So we dropped by Dollar General. She was in picking out some cards. And so I just hit my little TED Talk button on my phone and thought, well, I'll just look across the thing. And this one caught my eye. I think it was, the name of it was Alone But Connected, or Connected and Alone, or something like that. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I started watching it. And by the time Net had gotten back to the car, I thought, yeah, I'm doing the podcast on this. So the speaker's name was Sherry Turkle, T-U-R-K-L-E. She had just authored her third book, I think. And the name of the book is Alone Together. I believe that's what the name of the book is, Alone Together. And it is about the effect of technology... effect of technology on our lives in terms of our social interactions. As it turns out, she had given a TED Talk, I think she said 15 years ago, on a new book that she had written called The Second Self or something like that, where she was very optimistic at that point about the use of technology and about the use of virtual worlds, because everything was sort of coming online at that point, of people having avatars and relating to people online in virtual worlds. And she was a psychiatrist, I'm not sure which, working at MIT and studying these interactions. And she really, at that time, saw it as a very hopeful development, because what she assumed, and I guess some of the people with her assumed, was that people would take this technology and through their interactions online would then learn to become better in the real world, that they would live better in the real world because of their interactions in the virtual world. Now, I may not have had the framework 15 years ago to describe why that would be a false statement from the get-go and a false expectation from the get-go. But if I knew then what I knew now, and someone told me that this virtual world was going to lead to a better experience in the real world for people, I would have smiled and said, I don't think so. And the reason I could have told you that then was my reaction to email. I can't remember when I first started using email. Let's see, 15 years ago would have put us somewhere in the late 1990s. Probably would have been mid-1990s when I started using email. I can't remember for sure. It was sometime during the Nitpicker's Guide series era where I had put up my first website and I was beginning to correspond with people via email. And I hated it. I just hated it. Because as I would correspond with people, I would write and they would write me back and I would read what they wrote and I had no additional information. All I had was these words on a page. And it was so easy, it seemed to me, to misunderstand what the person was trying to say. And I would have to be so careful to say, wait, stop. Is there additional ways that you can interpret this? And this was actually before, as I recall, this was actually before I really stumbled into the whole framework with flesh and spirit. But even at that point, I could tell there was a struggle internally in me because it was so easy to misinterpret. Whereas if I was talking to somebody face to face, I was not only getting the words, but I was getting the intonation of the voice and I was getting the body language, and it was so much easier for me to understand how I should respond and how I should contribute to the conversation to move it forward. And so I recognized even then in the early days of using email that the email experience was a reduction in the depth of communication. And I recognized that the ability to choose when you are going to respond and to edit your responses was a way of controlling and isolating yourself from the communication, from the raw communication. And quite frankly, one of the guidelines of the framework, if I had known then what I know now, is that any form of isolation where you are refusing to communicate with others is driven in some way by flesh, because isolation is flesh. Community is spirit. So anyways, I could have probably looked at that had I had my framework at that point and said, yeah, I don't think having people spend time in the virtual world is really going to improve their lives in the real world. And in fact, that's what has happened, because Sherry Turkle was very excited about all of the technology, but she said now in the intervening 15 years, she said, I'm still excited about it, but I see that technology is taking us places we don't want to go. And here, I'm just going to start saying this is what she said, and then after I finish, well, this is what she said, I'll say here's my reaction to all these things, because if you've listened to this at any time at all, I think you're going to immediately recognize that I'm going to say it's not the technology that's taking us there. It's the flesh that's taking us there, but that's okay. She has, over these last 15 years, she said, interviewed hundreds of people about their plugged-in lives. And she said what they've discovered, what she has come to, is that these psychological devices, these devices that we carry around in our pockets, are psychologically powerful. That it causes us to do things that we would have found surprising just a few years ago. Like people sitting in meetings, in business meetings, and texting at the same time. Not giving the meeting their full attention, texting at the same time. Or parents sitting at dinner, not paying attention to their children, but on their phones playing games and texting while their kids are saying, pay attention to us. These same children then who complain about their parents not paying attention to them, going into another room with their friends and instead of actually talking to their friends, sitting in their room on the bed or sitting at the desk, all separately texting on their phone and instead of actually talking to each other, texting to each other. And I saw this early on when we had some young ladies from a master's commission at our church staying with us. That we had two computers in the office and they had gotten on the computers and stuff. And they were laughing about it at that time. They were texting a bunch of their friends, but they were also texting. No, it wasn't texting. It was instant messaging. Because at that time, we didn't do much texting. But they were instant messaging their friends and each other as opposed to just talking to each other. And they were laughing about it. They thought it was funny. And I remember noting at the time, okay, that's interesting. That's interesting. She noted as well, Sherry Turkle, that people text at funerals and they don't think of anything about it. And she had this statement how people have come to her and said, you know, a really important skill to learn is to be able to make eye contact with people and text at the same time. Make eye contact with people and yet be able to text at the same time. And she said, people have told us, you know, it's hard, but you can learn to do it. Oh, yeah. She talked about a man who came to her and he said, you know, I don't really feel like I have colleagues at work anymore because everyone's so tied up in going to their email and getting online with their social media on their breaks that no one really talks anymore. And then he was honest enough to say, well, that's not really true. The problem really is that I don't want to be bothered talking to people anymore. She had a quote from an 18-year-old who just texting was his life. It was his mode of communication. Who said, you know, someday, sometime, I really am going to need to learn how to have a conversation with another person, but not today. Let me get my mail. And these are the kind of things that are going on because of these little devices that we carry around with us, according to her. She said the problem with conversations, the reason that people don't like conversations, is because conversations take place in real time, and you can't control what you're going to say. In the virtual world, we get to edit, we get to retouch, we get to shape the face, the voice of what we're going to present to the world. And she correctly noted in her speech that human relationships are rich and messy and demanding. And if we don't engage in human relationships and simply use these little devices that we have, that instead of having real conversation, we just have sporadic connections. She said at one point that Stephen Colbert had actually asked her an intriguing question. He said, well, but don't all those tweets, all those sips of online communication, don't they add up to one big gulp of conversation? And her opinion was, no, they don't. Because you never really get beyond just the surface level. All those little sips of connection don't really cost you anything because you can just do what you want when you want. She was saying that there's a lot of people now who are expressing that really they would want someday to have a more advanced version of Siri that would be like a best friend, that would solve that problem of feeling like no one is listening to me. Because she's saying that feeling is what drives us to want to spend time with machines. And she said we're vulnerable. She didn't say why we're vulnerable, but she said we are vulnerable to the pretend empathy that we get from these machines. That it leads us to expect more from technology and less from others. That we're lonely, but at the same time, we're afraid of intimacy, and we want the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. Isolation, isolation, isolation. You see isolation all over this. She talked about some deceptions that lead us to this place. The deception that we get, I was trying to think how to phrase that, that we can live a fulfilling life in spite of the fact that we get to put our attention wherever we want. That our lives can be full and we will always be heard. That our lives can be full and we will never have to be alone. So we can always be distracted. We can always be entertained. We can always choose to interact with whomever we want to, whenever we want to, only at the level that we want to. And she had a large conversation where she brought this around to the idea of solitude and the importance of solitude and how that really was the answer. But, you know, I don't think that solitude is necessarily the answer unless you're talking about solitude and reflection that causes you to be quiet and to be calm. Because, as you know, if you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, I believe there's a real key there. If you will get quiet and you will get calm and you will become comfortable with that, you will begin to sense that whispering that God is constantly doing into your spirit. And you'll begin to feel that connection. And that's why I think it's great that people meditate. I mean, you know, that put themselves in a state of mindfulness, even if they're not calling on Jesus, just quieting themselves, I think, is advantageous. Because they will feel this connection to something beyond themselves. And God can work with that. So it was an interesting talk. She did have this hopeful charge at the end of this talk that we need to tell ourselves to have more conversations and we need to seek out friends and we need to be aware of what these devices are doing to us and we can do better and all this kind of stuff. And I was listening to this and I thought, oh, okay, you know, I'm sorry, but this is not going to happen because the problem is not the devices. The problem is not the technology. The problem is the flesh. And the flesh is very, very good at what it does. And it loves all this isolation that comes from texting. It loves all the distractions that come from all these little online games. I mean, I have enough interactions with enough people through the week that I am always interested how in the midst of important conversations, people will just check out. start playing with their phone. And I'll think, you know, that's more convenient for you, but it's not bringing you to an environment of success, because what you've just done is pulled yourself back into a level of isolation. And when you do that over and over and over, you give the flesh an opportunity to construct a worldview around you that does embody these lives, that I get to put my attention wherever I want to, whenever I want to. I don't have any responsibility to any other person. And I need to be heard all the time. So anytime I want to dash off a note and on Facebook, then somebody needs to react and hear what I have to say. Because what that does is it exalts the self. It exalts me. And if everybody is exalting me, it never really gets us the opportunity to sacrifice some of our ego and the drive of ourselves to give to others. Because relationship is always about giving. And where you grow and where you become more mature is always in connection to a relationship, to something you're giving to and the other person is giving to you. That's where we become mature as human beings. And if the entire time we're off isolated in a corner, dashing off little text messages or playing little games, we never have the chance to truly sacrifice something for another person, to subjugate my desire of what I want to do right now to get the latest little woohoo for me. And I don't learn impulse control, if you want to put it into another term. And impulse control, as we've talked about in the past, is one of the core skills that leads you to fulfillment and maturity in life. So, when you're doing your texting, when you're doing your playing your games, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of that. But if people are around you and you're having a conversation and you've checked out, stop it. Put the phone down, turn off the ringer, flip it over, and engage with people, because what you will get out of that engagement is far more important than what you're going to get by simply drawing another picture in Draw Something. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.